Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining me today, it is Tom Roddy and Jonathan Northcroft. Guys, how are you? Tom, how are you keeping?
Yes, good, thanks, Nat. Yourself?
Yes, very, very well, thank you. It's going to be a busy one, I think, on this podcast. There's lots been happening this week, so it's going to be good to get our teeth into it all. Jonathan, how are you doing?
I'm really good, Nat. Yeah, I'm very well. How are you?
Yes, all is fine this end. It seems crazy that this weekend we've got the Community Shield and then it's sort of back to football. It all kind of kicks off the following weekend with the EFL Cup action, and it's like it's never stopped, and it hasn't in some ways.
It's bizarre, and I actually can't go to the Community Shield because I'm still quarantined from the Champions League in Lisbon. Yeah, so I'm almost serving a ban from last season before this one starts.
Oh my goodness, that's cruel, yeah, very cruel. No. But yeah, Tom, it's sort of all coming round fast, isn't it, this new season?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like there was a break at all.
No.
And for certain clubs, there definitely weren't at all. But no, I mean, I think as well, like the fixture lists coming out, I never get that excited about them anyway, really, but especially this season, it only just finished. You understand the kind of likes of Leeds coming up and for the first time in 16 years, but for the short break, it wasn't all that thrilling.
No, it wasn't. And I know what you mean about the fixture list day, because you kind of think, well, you know you are going to play everybody twice, so why do we get so excited? But it's just one of those things, isn't it, that we have to look and see, you know, who you're playing around Boxing Day and all those sort of key games that we all like to look forward to. But yeah, it is not fast until that new season kicks off. And we've got loads coming up as we talk England, Chelsea and fax machines. All will be revealed. But first, could Lionel Messi really be on his way to Manchester?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
So we start with the big story on the back of the Times today. Manchester City are optimistic about pulling off the biggest transfer coup in the history of English football by signing none other than Lionel Messi. The story explains that the club have worked for more than a week to tie up a deal, and a City source revealed their confidence that a deal can be made. City appear to be in pole position ahead of Inter Milan to sign the 33-year-old after he informed Barcelona via a registered document that he wanted to leave the club where he has spent his entire career. City have made it clear through Ferran Soriano, the chief executive who was previously at Barcelona, that they have the finances to conclude a deal and pay a transfer fee if necessary, but think a free move can be achieved. Jonathan, can you actually comprehend the idea that Messi, the Lionel Messi, could actually be on his way to the Premier League?
Well, I mean, anything's possible. This year just feels like one long dream, but I guess for people in England, it would be one of the very nicest parts of that dream. I mean, it's something we've all, I guess, in our mind's eye tried to picture at certain points, watching Messi, watching his genius unfold, always in the Champions League or international or Spanish league setting. And part of me has always wondered what would it be like? What would it be like to cover him week in, week out in games? Of course, I've covered him in Europe, and you try and conjure up all the different matchups. You know, I mean, I don't know, for some reason my mind immediately jumps to Sheffield United and, you know, seeing if Baldock and Stevens could limit him on the flanks, and you know Connell could get him in the middle, and you think of Burnley and all those kind of scenarios. I mean, it would be a real treat for us. He's such a genius, and showing Genius has got a way of flourishing everywhere, and just seeing how he would find a way to succeed, which I'm sure he would in England, would be fascinating.
Have you seen him live before, Jonathan?
Yeah, I've seen him in the Champions League, yes, home and away. But the performances that really sort of spring to mind most actually were in the 2014 World Cup with Argentina. And I think until seeing him in that tournament, I probably hadn't quite appreciated how good a passer of the ball he is. Yes, his dribbling, I'd seen that, and his goal scoring, of course. But he played a slightly deeper role at times for Argentina in that game. And there's a pass he played against Belgium that it's just like burned in my mind forever. It'll be one of those football memories I take to the grave, that was just sublime, like, out of this world, a long pass from the outside of his foot to release Di Maria. And I can still see it in my mind. In Brazil, yeah, it was incredible. I've seen it close up, but to see that, you know, to see that over a season would just be marvellous.
To see him week in, week out. What about you, Tom? Have you ever been lucky enough to witness him in the flesh?
I've not actually, and I feel envious listening to Johnny talk. and I think also the shame is I'd love to see him play, and I'm determined to before he does retire. But there would be a kind of hint of disappointment about not seeing him play for Barcelona in a way. Mm. I mean, you take him whatever shirt he's wearing, whether he's wearing a raggedy vest down at the local park, I'd love to see that, but
I know what you mean, though. I mean, obviously that is where he's hit the heights of it. That's where he spent his entire footballing career, so it would seem odd to not see him in a Barcelona context. But we are getting excited about the prospect of him coming to the Premier League. It's not a done deal by any stretch, but for you, Tom, is Manchester City the most attractive offer to Messi?
I think it adds up. You've got the financial power to make it possible. You've got the quality of the team and the squad, and of course the project, which is what we keep hearing Messi is meant to be after, what he's looking for, a short-term project. And then you've also got the familiarity of a club which no other club could really offer him. At Barcelona, there's probably been no player at the top level who has had as much influence as a club than Messi's had at Barcelona. And I suspect he would feel at City, maybe not as much the influence, but the personal connection to those in power is already in place for him. Obviously, Guardiola as manager, Soriano's there, chief exec, Beguirassain as director of football, and I don't think the others who have the financial power to make this possible could really compete with that. The closest is probably PSG having Neymar and Mbappe, but otherwise I think it adds up for City.
It does seem as though there are so many things that point towards a Manchester City move would be the right move for Messi. Do you think, Jonathan, this would be a defining signing for Sheikh Mansour in that era at City?
Yeah, it would. It would be, I guess, if you're trying to build a football club, then it's kind of the ultimate prize if you're putting the building blocks together to get the best player in the world, maybe the best in history. So it would be the culmination of things. And, you know, it's not like they, when they took over Manchester City, they kind of did the Venkies at Blackburn thing and immediately chased Ronaldinho sort of thing. I know they signed Rubinho straight away, but very quickly then settled into a long-term plan. And there was a long-term plan behind recruiting Pep Guardiola, for example, with the recruitment of Ferran Soriano and Chiqui Beguerestan first to provide that Barcelona context. So Messi's always been part of the dream, a long-term dream that they've been working for and building for, and you know, one of the intriguing angles is that they could possibly swing this through their global network of clubs, which is one of the things that might enable them to sign him and I guess offload some of the costs and ambassadorial terms, and also offer him a bigger contract because he could then go to America at the end of his career. So that's another part of the architecture that they've been planning for. You know, they didn't put that in place to specifically get Messi, but they knew that made their business more attractive. So it's something they've been building towards, I guess. The ultimate thing, of course, is winning the Champions League for them. So that is the ultimate part of the design. But having Messi in a City shirt would have been right at the top of the kind of wish list when Sheikh Mansour took over. And this is closer than we've ever seen to it being realised.
It has also been reported in Spain that Pep Guardiola, who spent 4 years as his Barcelona manager, has spoken in person to Messi. Tom, I know you've alluded to this already, so I'll ask you, Jonathan. Could that relationship with Guardiola be the deciding factor in this deal?
Call me a horrible cynic. I think the deciding factor would probably be money, actually, because just getting him out and paying him the right money. But yes, I mean, stripping that away, in football terms, Messi's looking, I guess, to rediscover the love and the security that he felt he had at Barcelona. And, you know, Guardiola was the coach. He didn't invent Messi. I mean, Messi played in the Champions League final under Rijkaard in 2006 or something. But he certainly was the one that, I suppose, brought him to his peak. And they had probably the greatest success together. And I think knowing how, I think Guardiola's quite a kind of, is clannish the right word? He's quite a tight-knit person who trusts people that he knows, he's known for a long time, trusts his own, as it were, which is why there's a big network of Catalans around him. And I always got the impression Messi's the same, that he's a similar character, small, you know, introvert, closed circle. So for him to move anywhere, there'd have to be a lot of familiarity there, I think. And Pep, and not just him, but having Begueristan and Soriano, and probably, you know, there's other people there that were in Guardiola's circle for a long time. I think that would be really attractive to him. And of course, Pep as a coach, of course, would be the other layer to that.
Yeah, and there's his friend Sergio Aguero as well that happens to be at Manchester City. So there are, as I mentioned before, lots of key factors that could help to persuade Messi to join Manchester City. And Tom, would bringing Messi to the club be a bigger achievement for Guardiola than winning the league?
I think it would be a more memorable achievement than winning the league, and a more defining moment in his era at the club. Because I suppose, given the money Manchester City had, they'd won the league before Guardiola came. Obviously, that's something they wanted to do. They wanted to bring a style of football, but they were already in that category of clubs who you expected to be competing for the title. I mean, Guardiola is meant to take them to the next level in being a Champions League winning club. So, and I think Messi could help them do that. I also think that the saying about it being a sort of defining moment, City are now a global club, as Johnny spoke about, with their sort of network. And I think signing someone like Messi, or almost in the way that Tottenham getting Mourinho and taking that superstar status, I think it would be a defining moment in that way as well.
Even more importantly, for the City hierarchy, you touched on it a little bit there, Jonathan. Is Messi the missing link for the club and winning that elusive Champions League title?
I mean, yes and no, because it's actually not the area of the pitch that they need most to strengthen.
Very true.
But signing the best player in the world is possibly the best single piece of recruitment you can do to improve your team, however, wherever he plays. I guess the only thing is the lessons that we've seen, or the harsh lessons that Messi himself has learned over the last few years, is if the team isn't right, you won't win that Champions League. It's too difficult. And Barcelona have fallen short. And if you put Messi into the team that I saw lose to Lyon, then know that I don't think that would make the difference. So there have to be other improvements. They have to try and sign Koulibaly or someone else to improve them defensively. There has to be probably a bit of a change of approach there. But he is the biggest single thing, and he would, I guess, arrive on a bit of a mission as well. I would, they're close, and he would give them the best, a very good chance. But him and himself wouldn't quite be enough, I think. I'm kind of, the hesitancy in my voice is because I kind of, do I actually want to make any predictions against Lionel Messi's genius. It's just we've seen it for Barcelona, Argentina, him by himself. He can't win it alone. City are a marvellous team, but they've got obvious flaws, and they didn't go out of that Champions League because they're poor attacking-wise. They went out because they couldn't defend, and Guardiola didn't trust the defensive personnel that he had.
There are, of course, some potential stumbling blocks for City, with a looming legal dispute between Messi and Barcelona over whether he can leave for nothing. In normal circumstances, Barcelona would have pushed for a world record transfer fee, but both sides are anxious to avoid a court battle, and a likely compromise would be for the club to accept a fee of more than 100 million euros, the sum Juventus paid for Cristiano Ronaldo in 2018 when he was 33. Messi's contract is worth a minimum of £78 million a year in wages and image rights payments, and as much as £100 million with performance bonuses. There's also the question of a €70 million loyalty bonus due to be paid to Messi if he completes his four-year contract with Barcelona, which is due to expire in June of 2021, and would potentially be jeopardised if he moves before then. But should City ignore the financial cost to get him, or only do the deal, Tom, if it's truly beneficial for them?
I think it can only be beneficial to them to get Lionel Messi. I don't think there's really a downside to it, especially with a club with seemingly bottomless finances. I mean, the obvious concern is financial fair play, which they've had a problem with just over the last year. But given it was only 3 years ago that PSG spent £365 million on Neymar and Mbappe in one summer, I don't see it as being a particular problem for financial fair play in the long run now.
So what about you, Jonathan? Do you think FFP comes into this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that since City won their case at CAS, then they've just gone into full old-fashioned City transfer mode and serve Chelsea. And there's a feeling that whatever the laws is not going to apply as strictly as it used to. And I must admit, my personal sort of belief in FFP as a viable entity died that day with the City ruling. I think it is more or less dead. So yeah, I think the biggest worry would be, as I understand the financials, they could afford him if it was a free transfer. I mean, it would probably cost in the region of £200 million in wages over 3 years, which is a lot. But if you think about signing, a top player for, let's say, £80 million, giving them a five-year contract, it kind of works out at roughly the same. But if you do throw that transfer fee on top of it, if Messi can't win the right to leave for free, and there's the liability of a £600 million buyout, then not even Man City could afford that. And would they make their money back? Probably not in the short term. No amount of shirt sales or sponsorship deals is probably going to recoup it. But I think what they'd be thinking of is a long-term thing. That's the thing that elevates your club to, gives it that longevity, that kudos and glamour that you can mine for the next 50 years. So I guess that's what the financial argument for it would be.
What is your feeling on this, Tom? Do you think we will see Messi at City?
Maybe it's the optimistic side of things, or just the hope of seeing him week in, week out. And as I said, on a personal note, having been watching him play, ticking that off, I think so. The problem, I think, is that there's kind of been a talk of whether this is a power play at Barcelona, with the whole dispute with Bartomeu and the board, but going to this extent of actually, sending the document in, the transfer request in, it feels to me like it's gone too far for him to go back. And I think City makes the most sense of any club by far, really. So yes is the answer.
you're going for a strong yes. But it is interesting, and it's right to raise the point of the power play and the power struggle at Barcelona. There is obviously some ill feeling towards the current president, Bartomeu. And there is a suggestion, Jonathan, of course, that this is all been brought about by, you know, trying to force him out of power. A new president comes in. Xavi, one of obviously Messi's former teammates and friends, comes in as the new boss. And it's all happy and rosy once again because Messi then decides to stay. But if that doesn't happen, what's your hunch? Are you as optimistic as Tom is?
No, I'm not. I'm probably older and more cynical just generally. But I think we've seen it before. I think that's why there's a suspicion of it being a power play. We've seen this before. But as Tom's right to say, this is, it's never got to this extent. They've gone a long way down the road, both parties. Since Messi's transfer request or whatever, then it's gone into the hands of the lawyers. It hasn't ended up in talks or anything. So there's a big rift. But if I was betting, I still see the most likely outcome as a Bartomeu resignation and Messi staying. But it's now almost 50-50, I would say. It's never been closer. And I think he's demonstrated at last that he will seriously contemplate leaving. This isn't I'm just unhappy. He'll walk, I think, if he doesn't get what he wants. He's made that clear. It's not, this isn't a kind of bluff, I think is what I'm trying to say. So he's made that clear. But I do think that ultimately it ends in... I can't see how Bartomeu's position's tenable at all. It didn't feel tenable before any of this, to be honest. After 8-2, it didn't feel tenable. And I suspect this might just push it over the brink.
Yeah, this could well be the tipping point. Now, there was one particular detail of Messi's transfer request to Barcelona that caught the eye. The biggest player on the planet sent the request, so it's suggested, by fax. Now, that might not be a fax in the way some of us think of a fax, but it does conjure up some sort of an image of Messi happily living in a social media-free world with no smartphones, nor tablets and computers, and perhaps just lives in the 1980s. But the question is, Tom, when was the last time you sent a fax?
I don't think I ever have, actually.
No!
I remember my father was a salesman and used to get his appointments through on a fax, and his office used to call through each day and tell me to get off the internet as the line would only work on one machine at the time, so the fax couldn't come through.
Okay, so would you even know how to use a fax machine, Tom?
I think so. I'm fairly sure I could cobble through.
Okay. Well, that's something. That's better than, you know, you see some of these like videos, don't you, on social media of people being given, a videotape or a cassette tape, and they've been given a machine to put it into and they have no idea what they're doing with it. So at least you're on the right track there, Tom. Jonathan, what about you and fax machines? Were they your friends?
Yes, I've used faxes. I'm very old.
I have too, though. I have.
Yeah, well, you know, they were quite the thing in the day, weren't they?
They were.
I used to do an interview requests were always by fax. I used to send my expenses by fax, more at the point. I remember a colleague of mine used to even conduct interviews by fax, you know, in the way that people sometimes, you can do an email interview now with somebody who doesn't want to speak on the phone, but you might be able to email them some questions. And he used to sort of send, you know, one question faxes and get answers back. And I think it was an agent he did it with. Yeah, he worked for the Scottish Sun. Yeah, and he'd get faxes back, and that would be how he interviewed sometimes. But I remember them only too well, I'm afraid.
Yes, I remember them too, and getting that little report, it's been delivered. Yes. I remember getting all that. Yes, I remember that.
Do you remember when you'd phone, you thought it was somebody's phone number and it would actually be their fax machine?
Oh, and that horrible noise that would connect it on you. Oh, yes, I do. Oh. See, Tom, this is all, you missed out on all this. It's brilliant. But of course, I mean, Jonathan, I don't want to hark on about how old we must both be, but you must have used to have to send match reports over the phone and things like that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, look. I want to make clear first of all, I'm only 49. I'm not, I'm not like Victorian or something like that. But yeah, I mean, just thinking through some of the old technology. I mean, I remember car phones. Do you remember car phones?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Before mobiles, real movers and shakers had car phones. So I remember getting a few players and managers on their car phone. Match reports by phone, definitely. I used to. My early days would write them out longhand, and you know, you had to basically race to a public phone somewhere, or even like the Grand National in Aintree, which I did a couple of times. You might knock on someone's door if you were desperate. You couldn't get a phone and just ask them if you could use their phone, and then you'd phone a copy taker who would basically, it was an audio typist who would take down what you'd written. You'd get some pretty embarrassing errors that way.
Do you know what, Jonathan? I was one of those people. I was a copy taker when I was at university, yeah. And I used to dread it because I used to think, what if I don't know how to spell this? It panicked me. It really did.
Well, did you ever do the Scottish match reports? Because I remember feeling, yeah, we used to phone, I think it was in Preston, there was a bureau, and we used to feel really sorry for some of the Scottish names and Scottish accents. Clearly the copy taker didn't have any idea what you were talking about, Falkirk v Kilmarnock or something like that. Do you remember acoustic couplers? I'm sure you're too young for that, Nat. Acoustic couplers?
No, what's that? Well, oh gosh, we're really going back in the ages, I feel. I'm loving this conversation.
This almost feels a dream that this ever happened, but I've actually like checked up on the internet that this thing did exist, and I didn't dream it. So acoustic couplers, and I used these at the 98 World Cup from France. They were like a pair of suckers that you put on either end of a telephone and plugged into your laptop. And then by some kind of magic, the copy that you had on your laptop would be sent through the phone using these suction pads. They crop up in 80s films, actually. You can find them in a few 80s films. We were sent to the France World Cup. I had my first mobile phone, but that wasn't to be used for copies, all that kind of stuff, because the bills were just too astronomical. So it was acoustic couplers from the hotel room for sending copy.
Well, I have never heard of that before. But there you go. I'm guessing that was short-lived, the acoustic couplers, because I don't remember them. But anyhow. No. Well, there you go. But we do have to question, do we sort of miss some of the old technology that we now, no longer have in modern life? So let me ask you, Jonathan, first, do you prefer books over tablets, or are you more happy now to have everything on hand on an iPad or whatever it is that you might read off Kindles and things?
I'm still a big book in the hand reader. Although I have actually got into reading newspapers on my smartphone now, something I never thought I'd do. So I guess I'm changing as well. But I'd still read a book over a tablet.
Yes. So you are moving with the times. That's no pun intended. but what about you, Tom? Do you still like a good old-fashioned book?
Yeah, I mean, I got a Kindle and thought it was great, and then read a book on an old traditional hardback back, and have left the Kindle for good now. I don't think it'll. You can't pass on a book in a Kindle. You can't lend it to someone, can you?
That's true.
I think it's a shame.
That is true. What about Polaroid cameras, Tom? Did you ever have one of those? The old school ones, not the new version.
I was going to say, I probably had one, but it was probably in a retro sense. I'm afraid so.
Oh, see, I used to love my Polaroid camera, especially when you'd sit there and you'd be like wafting it, trying to dry it off. Jonathan, does that ring a bell?
I remember the photographers that used to go to games. I've seen drying off their negatives and stuff is a big thing. But my eldest daughter's got one. As Tom says, it's a kind of retro thing now, but it's good for kids because digital just, kind of gets lost, and you don't necessarily want them running around with your phone. But little Polaroids.
Do you still have to dry them off though? Like I was saying,
No. They come out very small and dry. Yeah, so drying technology is there now.
Well, there you go. They've got some sort of fan inside them that make them all right. And what about vinyl? Well, you obviously, Jonathan, you must have loved the vinyls.
Yeah, I've got my first records were vinyl. I still got a few vinyl records. I remember cassettes as well. I used to buy a lot of stuff on cassette, and I think some real hipster bands now release things on cassette just to be even.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, just to be even more kind of like,
ooh, I like
muso
that.
And retro, yeah, than vinyl. But yeah, no, I and then of course the CD was really exciting. Wow, the CD. And it's funny how the CDs kind of disappeared, and there's still vinyl and the old cassette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny? I used to love going every Saturday into my local Woolworths to get, yeah, you know, to see the top 40 and pick up my little cassette singles and all sorts. And I remember having Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion, Part 1 and 2 on cassette. Oh, yeah. I loved it.
The top 40. What happened to that?
I know. Oh, the proper top 40, that exactly. was. Tom, are you just sitting thinking, what are these old fogies talking about?
Well, I had a very embarrassing moment the other day, or I found it embarrassing, where I have a record player and had one on, and I think I was washing up at the time, and I called out to it to skip the song, thinking it would be Alexa.
No! Oh, that's brilliant. Fantastic. I wish that was caught on camera. That would have been brilliant. Oh, dear. Do you know, it's nice to take a little trip down memory lane, wasn't it? Oh, let's move on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Manchester United goalkeeper Dean Henderson has signed a new six-year contract with the club and will go head-to-head with David De Gea next season for the number one jersey at Old Trafford. The deal will see the 23-year-old earning up to £120,000 a week, making him one of the best-paid goalkeepers in world football. Henderson spent the past two campaigns on loan at Sheffield United, helping the Blaze to promotion to the Premier League in 2019 before an impressive debut top-flight campaign last season where they finished ninth. How good is Dean Henderson, Tom?
Well, I think I remember listening to Chris Wilder talking last year in quite a few post-match interviews where he would play down the performances of Dean Henderson and that he was in goal to make saves. That was his job, so he wasn't going to go overboard with it. And really, I wonder whether part of it was to do with the fact he just hoped he could hold on to him for one more year, because he really is that good in a time when we do have quite a few decent England goalkeepers. I think he's very quickly going to become the number one, and I think that's why we're seeing him be promoted quickly through at Manchester United, a lot quicker than we probably expected him to, given David De Gea's role.
So is this a good deal, Jonathan, for Henderson and the club, do you think?
It makes sense. I mean, you kind of balk when you sort of reflect on him being one of the best paid goalkeepers in the world, but that's just where we are with Premier League wages and playing for Manchester United. But they I don't think they can lose with this as a United, because they've tied him down on the long term. He's clearly going to be a first class goalkeeper for someone, and they'll be able to, you know, cash in on him if it doesn't work out for him, if De Gea maybe, you know, retains his form or Henderson doesn't quite cut it. He'll still be, I'm sure he'll be a, you know, very good Premier League goalkeeper. So they can't lose from it from that point of view. But from his point of view, I think it's the right thing. You know, the idea that he should go on loan again, I think he's done enough of that. I think De Gea is vulnerable. This is probably his opportunity to try and displace him. If you want to demonstrate to your manager that you've got the confidence to be the Manchester United goalkeeper, then you say, yeah, I'm staying and I'm going to get that guy's shirt. So I think Solskjaer will like what Henderson wanted to stay and fight for his place as well. So it's a good deal. Whether it will happen, whether he's good enough, I'm still not sure. But it's encouraging news. I think it's the right step for him. And I think we will find out.
So what, you're not sure what this season, if he can become number one, or in general at Manchester United?
No, I just say that because the standards required to be a goalkeeper for one of the very, very top clubs are enormous. You know, you can make a mistake for Sheffield United, and he did make a couple last year, made one against Liverpool, and you get another chance. You make it at the top, for the top clubs, it's just unrelenting, and you have, you know, it's difficult for players to deal with that sometimes. That said, he's always struck me, and everything I've heard about him is that he's a very self-confident and mentally tough lad. So he probably can handle the mental side. But as I say, it's only a small percentage of players, and especially goalkeepers and strikers, I think, that can play at the top clubs because of that unforgiving nature. And until you see them in action, that's why I've got doubts. Just because I haven't seen him do it yet. Got the potential, but until you see it, you can't say he's definitely a Manchester United goalkeeper.
Tom, Jonathan's mentioned there about David De Gea will want to recapture his form, because obviously a lot of us have been questioning him because of what happened last season for Manchester United. When you consider we have the Euros next summer, De Gea will want to be playing in that. You'd have thought Henderson, being an ambitious young goalkeeper, will also have an eye on that as well. So do you not think in some ways it's surprising that he hasn't thought to go out on loan again this coming season to try and get himself into maybe that number one England spot?
I see what you mean. There is a bit of a risk there that if De Gea starts the season and if he continues, if he returns to the form that, you know, I think he won, he's been named in the Premier League Team of the Year 5 of the last 8 seasons. So if he returns to that form, then he's still undroppable. And so it's slightly a risk there. It reminds me a little bit of the situation at Chelsea a few years back when they had Petr Cech and Thibaut Courtois on their books. And you've got two top-class goalkeepers who, both of which, one is meant to be the heir to the other's throne. But it's different in two ways. The first is that there were big question marks over David De Gea, whether he's still the same goalkeeper he was. And the other is the age. Of course, he's 3 years younger than Cech was, I think, at that time, and has many years left. So the decision over Henderson is sort of an indication to everyone involved that Henderson is kind of taking over, I think. So I think he should be starting sort of straight away.
Interesting. Well, last season at Sheffield United, Henderson made more saves and conceded fewer goals than De Gea in the Premier League. They both kept 13 clean sheets, but crucially, De Gea made 3 errors leading to goals compared to just the one from Henderson. De Gea has made 7 errors leading to goals over the past 2 seasons in the Premier League, more than he'd made over the previous 7 campaigns combined. And in June, the Manchester United manager, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, said he expects Henderson will become both England and United's future number one goalkeeper. Lots at stake then for both of these players coming into this new season. Where do you stand on this one, Jonathan? Should Henderson be given the opportunity to start as Manchester United's number one?
So it's a tough one because De Gea's, you know, what service he's given United, he's been captain. And to sort of knock him out of it now without giving him the first dibs at the shirt would be a real hard one for him to recover from personally. So that is there's a man management element to it. But if you're going on who is the likeliest bet right now, I think I'd agree with Tom that just from what we saw of last season, Henderson is probably in the better form and right now is a safer bet. So I'm giving you a bit of a fence-sitting question answer, but that's what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has got to weigh up. What does it do to David De Gea if he drops him straight away? I think maybe the answer is that there's a lot of games and you give one of them the Champions League campaign, maybe like Barca did with Ter Stegen and Bravo a few years ago, and you give one of them, or you give one of them the cups and you give one of them the league, let's say. And that might be the way to do it in the short term.
And that certainly would be the diplomatic way of doing it. But obviously, like we mentioned, De Gea had a difficult season last season for Manchester United. Tom, you've suggested that maybe they should give Henderson the opportunity to try out as number one. If that is the case, would Manchester United just be better off getting rid of De Gea?
Quite possibly, yeah. I suppose you've got the insurance policy of if everything went really wrong with Dean Henderson, then you've got a more than capable goalkeeper still there. But if they're showing every faith in Henderson that he will be, you know, that he can be United's number one, then I actually found it strange to happen this way round, with the 5-year deal that Henderson signed, whether they would have got rid of De Gea maybe before that was done, because they could have got maybe more money on his a fee if they were going to sell him. So I'd be surprised, unless he decided that he wanted to leave, I'd be surprised if he left this summer.
Well, this week, Henderson was named in the England squad for September's Nations League games against Iceland and Denmark. He's yet to make his England debut, being in the squad with England's current number one, Jordan Pickford, as well as Burnley's Nick Pope. When asked about his goalkeeping situation, Gareth Southgate said this: "I think we have three decent goalkeepers. I think they are the best three in the country at the moment. In every position on the field, we've got to have that competition. It's 10 months since we played. There have been fluctuations in form during that time. I've also got to bear in mind that Jordan has had excellent performances for us with England, has never let us down in terms of his performances for us." Let's put our international hats on this one. And Jonathan, if you wouldn't mind, just pretend you're English, maybe. No, but no, I don't want you to do that. Absolutely not. But in terms of England, should Jordan Pickford keep his place? Has he done enough to remain as England's number one?
Well, I think Gareth's got to try. I think he's got to give a serious look to the other two this year, because he's actually got 16 games. I think, when you count it up, there might be 16 England games this year. There's only four get-togethers. So there's sort of longer periods, sort of three fixtures at a time, I think, in two of them. And I think he's just got to use that, because a problem England have had going into tournaments has been not being, having a number one and no sort of decent number twos, because they haven't been played enough. And yeah, Pickford, has he let England down? No. Has he shown vulnerability? Yes. I mean, he did at the Nations League. He had a very good World Cup, of course. But I do think Gareth just needs to find alternatives, just so that he knows what's what. And Henderson has definitely got, you know, got to be one of those things, players he tries out. Pope's never had a proper run. And maybe he needs to look at Ramsdale as well, just so that when he goes to that tournament, he's got a really clear idea of what's what. Because Pickford isn't so convincing that you just say, you know what, we've got our number one and there's no question about it.
Yeah.
I think they do need backup options.
It does, though, sound, Tom, when you look back to what Southgate said about Jordan Pickford, you know, he is saying, well, we've got to think back to those England performances. He's never let us down. And I don't know, in some ways that suggests that maybe Southgate wants to stick by Jordan Pickford. But when you look at his club form and his performances over a season, hasn't been brilliant. Should a goalkeeper be dropped because of club form, even if he's had a good record with the England team?
Well, I think Southgate has also spoken about, throughout his time in charge, about picking the squad based on players who are in form for their clubs. You know, we've just seen Danny Ings get called up for the first time in 5 years because of, you know, he's forced himself into it. And I think we've seen people drop out because of their club form, like John Stones and of course Kyle Walker, who's back now, but he seemed to drop out because of his form. So I think club form has to come into it with the goalkeeper as well. And Jordan Pickford's made quite a few errors in the last couple of years that doesn't suggest you'd have complete faith in him. And Johnny's completely right. I completely agree in that England need a goalkeeper who you do have faith in going into the tournament, and someone who's had quite a few games as well. It can't be a lottery heading up to it.
Chelsea have signed England left-back Ben Chilwell from Leicester on a five-year deal for £45 million. Chilwell is Chelsea's third addition of the summer after the arrivals of winger Hakim Ziyech, who's 27, from Ajax, and the striker Timo Werner, 24, from RB Leipzig. The defender, 23, is a Leicester Academy product who made his debut for the club in 2015 and had a contract with the Foxes until 2024. Now, he missed the final five matches of the 2019-20 season with a foot injury. Chelsea took fourth place and a Champions League place at the expense of Leicester on the final day of the Premier League season in July. Is Ben Chilwell ready to make the step up to Chelsea, Jonathan?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, Leicester's defence was better than Chelsea's defence last year. So I would say he's got no worries about that. He's a very confident lad who, when he made his England debut, he had that knack of making it look as if he'd played for England for quite a long time. He'll see himself as capable. His confidence and ability will take him there. So it's a pretty good signing. I do have a caveat, which is that Chilwell's best part of his game is probably going forward and not going the other way. And maybe Chelsea, you'd say that the whole Chelsea team. But he's a wonderful footballer. And he'll fit in with that young team that they're trying to build.
Do you think, Jonathan, that he could have stayed if Leicester had made the top four?
No, I don't think so, because this is something that this one's been worked on for about 18 months, and he's seen this as a progression for himself for quite some time. So, I mean, had they made the top four at the expense of Chelsea? Possibly, but I think this was quite a long way down the line even before the end of the season.
Well, he's not the first Leicester player, of course, to move to Stamford Bridge. He's joining fellow Foxes Danny Drinkwater and N'Golo Kante at Chelsea, which continues that model of selling one of their stars every year since Kante left for Chelsea in 2016. Drinkwater followed him to West London in 2017. Other outgoings have seen Riyad Mahrez moving to Manchester City in 2018, and Harry Maguire joined Manchester United in 2019. It balances the books and allows reinvestment for Leicester on what is not a bad return at all. Those five players cost a total of £24.1 million. Leicester then sold them collectively for £250 million over 4 years, and still finished above Arsenal and Tottenham last season. When you hear those figures that I've just mentioned, Tom, is this shrewd business from Leicester?
It's a hell of a lot of money for a left back, isn't it? Even though they are becoming increasingly, fullbacks becoming increasingly influential and important figures in a team. And it's just another step on Leicester's reputation as a brilliant club that goes about their business the right way. I also wonder whether there's an element, like Johnny said, this was a deal that was going for quite a while, has been on the cards for quite a while. But as well with other deals this kind of summer, I wonder whether there's some element of cashing in before the real implications of the COVID-19 crisis actually impact football. I've felt that there's a feeling that a year on from now we might see a few transfer fees deflate a little bit, so that there may be an element of that. But Leicester are certainly a club to be admired with their history in the transfer market.
Chilwell, as we mentioned, then ended last season with an injury which has ruled him out of England duty, and Gareth Southgate didn't pick a recognised left-back in his 24-man squad for the upcoming Nations League games against Iceland and Denmark. These are the defenders that he's chosen. Trent Alexander-Arnold, Eric Dyer, Joe Gomez, Michael Keane, Tyrone Mings, Kieran Trippier and Kyle Walker. So, Tom, who is going to play left-back?
I'd have thought Joe Gomez possibly will do. I mean, it would be a shame out of the centre-backs there. He's probably the most established now without Harry Maguire. But, of course, when he did come in at Liverpool, when he was first coming through, he did play left-back, and he's very capable of that, unless Southgate is going to play Kyle Walker there. I mean, it did seem a strange decision to me not to have any left backs in the squad. The one sort of omission that surprised me more than Jack Grealish was not having Bukayo Saka in the squad, but for his incredible form at Arsenal and for this reason as well, you know, the versatility he has and being a left back, being short of them in the squad, I saw it as an opportunity.
Bukayo Saka called up to the England under-21s instead of the senior side. Who do you think could play left back in your mind, Jonathan?
Yeah, no, I agree with Tom that the most likely player is probably Gomez. I guess Tyrone Mings could just about
Yes,
do it.
He has played as left-back
in
his career.
Whether you'd want him to play as an international left-back, I don't know. But then again, Iceland are a bit of a set-piece team. Don't really attack you down the wings, so maybe that's part of the thinking. We were looking at the squad, talked to Gareth on Tuesday as part of a Sunday's group, and we were trying to figure out, is he going back three? But there's no natural wing-backs in there. So it is the weirdest part of the squad, I'd say. And Tom's bang on. Saka was the natural one to get the choice, get a chance. I think apart from him, you may be looking at Bertrand or Cresswell or someone like that. But it's a funny one because there's the game against Denmark as well, of course, and they probably will attack you down the flank.
What about Ben Chilwell then, Tom? Do you think he can go on to become not only Chelsea's but England's number one left back? Because no one's really nailed down that position since Ashley Cole. So could it be Ben Chilwell's?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of talent there. I mean, it will, you know, talking about Bukayo Saka, it will be interesting to see how he develops over the next few years. But I think Ben Chilwell isn't as, right now, he's not as capable as Ashley Cole was defensively. And he's probably not quite as good as him going forward yet. But there's certainly the potential there, and I think as well if he gets to play consistently as the number one choice, then I think he can challenge Cole's kind of title. Ashley Cole was just the world class left back and one of the only real world class players in that England team.
So Chilwell is another new face in at Chelsea. It doesn't seem as though they're going to stop there either. There are still those rumours of Kai Havertz joining. So that spending isn't ending anytime soon. And when you consider how much they've already spent, I think it's in excess of 130 million now. Is Frank Lampard under some pressure to win a trophy because of all this activity in the transfer market, Jonathan?
Yes. I mean, all managers are always under pressure at Chelsea. And Frank did pretty well last year. In fact, I think he did very well. But in Chelsea terms, there's always a question if you don't win something. And I think he will be expected to deliver. And very few Chelsea managers actually go past 2 years anyway. So he'll be coming to the end of that by the end of the season. It's interesting. I mean, we you know, since Roman Abramovich took over, kind of guessing what's in his mind has been a sort of regular thing for Chelsea watchers. And why he's, you know, rediscovered his taste for the transfer market is not quite clear. But Chelsea are really good in business terms, and I suspect this is possibly driven by a business imperative. Just the feeling that there are bargains to be had at the moment, there are top players to be had at knockdown prices, and that they're going to use this moment to sign them. I'm still not convinced that, a bit like Man City, I'm still not convinced that they've quite solved the actual problems that they had, which were defensive ones. I know they might they might well be getting Thiago Silva, and they've just signed Malang Sarr, who's going to be put back on loan. Chilwell, as I said, is a really nice footballer, but maybe defensively isn't his best part of his game. So I still have a question mark as to whether Frank can deliver that trophy this year with that defence. And of course, if he doesn't, you know, that relationship he's got with Abramovich will have to be really strong.
Tom, what do you think the minimum requirement will be for Chelsea and Frank Lampard this season?
I think there has to be progress from last year. There were not that Frank used them much as excuses, but there were mitigating circumstances last year with Hazard's departure and with the transfer ban. There's none of that now. They've so far, and it's likely to be the case when the summer finishes, they've had the best transfer window of any team in the league, and that squad has been strengthened massively. I completely agree with Johnny that the central defence is what needs addressing big time. Goalkeeper needs addressing as well. And with Thiago Silva coming in as a bit of a stopgap, it seems, it may work, but I don't know whether it's the solution to kind of get them as a Premier League contender. But I think there will need to be progress. They'll need to be at least that third team, and I think they do need to be competing for the Premier League title. And they need to be. You can't have the exit from the Champions League in the way they did this year with a squad like this. I don't think it can be humiliating, really.
Well, it is a big season ahead then for Chelsea, and that is it for now. Many thanks to Jonathan and to Tom as well. Remember to subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for award-winning journalism on every platform. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. Take care.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.